since I was last with you, we've lost several significant members of our community. In fact, in the email that I sent out to all of you announcing the death of Ron Nielsen, I told you that in the 5 years that Melora and I have served this congregation, it feels like the ebb and flow of life and love, and particularly loss, ebbs and flows and moves in seasons, just like our being and our existence. And we seem right now to be in a time, a season in our church community of loss. And so I want to invoke the names of those who have died since June 21st, who were members of our community. And then I want to invite us into a time of meditation and silent reflection, because I also know that there are those in this community who have lost people whose names I will not invoke aloud, but I know that many of you are carrying weights of loss and worry and anxiousness about the health or well-being of someone you love or have lost this summer. First stone is for the first loss I heard of this summer, and that is the life of Margaret Shortliff. This stone is for that vivacious woman whose great sense of humor I had the chance to be around a few times, and for her daughter Dale, Margaret Shortliff. This stone is for the second life lost to us this summer that I heard of, the life of Vera Tudor, who was struggling a lot these last few years and had had some falls recently. Her two beloved nieces and the rest of her family celebrated her life in a picnic at Mackenzie Bight just this past week, and this stone is for Vera Tudor. This first week back at work, one of the first phone calls Melora made was about Cameron Ejida. And we were both not only surprised to have learned over the summer that she began hospice care, but even more surprised to make a phone call only to discover that she had died the night before. I feel as if Cameron should be sitting in the back in her usual spot, ducking out before we sing Carry the Flame, making a witty comment to me on the way out the door. And those of us who were in her Soul Matters group this past year heard lots of thoughtful and witty and deep reflections from her as she wrestled with cancer and reviewed her own life. So this stone is for the indomitable Cameron Ejida. When someone lives more than 90 years, you somehow suspect that when they go, it won't sting quite so much. And yet, I was so sad to hear that Ron Nielsen passed away. And after a little back and forth with their daughter, Mary, this week, I'm happy to share with you that we have decided we will have an informal service for Ron, either in late September or early October, after the family has their chance to have their own celebration. And I'm even more pleased to say that Wilma will attend. Ron and Wilma, many of you know, the hospitality, the generosity of spirit. The first word that came into my heart when I thought of Ron Nielsen was quintessential gentleman. Gentle man, in the deepest sense of that word. And we miss him. And so this stone and our celebration later this fall represents the life of that pillar of our community and that sweet, sweet spirit that was Ron Nielsen. And now, into the silence that we will now share, I invite you to bring into your heart's eye all those people, all those loves and lives and losses that you are carrying on your heart, knowing that when we lift them into this silent communion of spirits, whether we envision it as meditating on their name, as praying for their spirit, whatever vision we have of what it is we do in this time, that this shared time of reflection holds power and holds meaning. So now, into this silence, I drop a final stone. May the ripples of the love in this room, may the ripples of our lives spread out into our community and into the world. Let us share now some silent togetherness. Well, you can tell I'm out of practice since I already flubbed the order of service. Thanks to Lorna and the flautists for not shaking their heads at me in consternation. But it's good to be back. I'm one of those ministers for whom worship was one of the reasons I got into ministry. I really am kind of a church junkie in that way, so it's really great to be back in worship with you this morning. This morning's message begins with a reading, as it usually does with me. This morning's reading is from one of my favorite spiritual writers and essayists and educators and Quakers, Parker Palmer, who wrote an essay entitled Fierce with Reality, Living and Loving Well to the End. He begins the essay with a quotation from a woman named Florida Scott Maxwell. You need only claim the events of your life to make yourself yours. When you truly possess all you have been and done, you are fierce with reality. Palmer goes on to write, I wanted a life of personal fulfillment that served others well, a life of love of self and others. And I knew that getting there would require me to be fierce with reality. But I devoutly wished there would be for an easier path than the one Scott Maxwell recommends. Today, at age 76, I know Scott Maxwell got it right. There are no shortcuts to wholeness. The only way to become whole is to put our arms lovingly around everything we have shown ourselves to be. Self-serving and generous, spiteful and compassionate, cowardly and courageous, treacherous and trustworthy. We must be able to say to ourselves and to the world at large, I am all of the above. If we can't embrace the whole of who we are, embrace it with transformative love, we'll imprison the creative energies hidden in our own shadows and flee from the world's complex mix of shadow and light. But if we are willing to move through the pain of honest self-examination toward the grace of compassionate self-acceptance, the rewards are great. when we can say, I am all of the above, we become more at ease in our own skin, more at home on the face of this richly diverse earth, more accepting of others who are no more or less flawed than we are, and better able to live as life givers to the end of our days. Wholeness is the goal, but wholeness does not mean perfection. It means embracing brokenness as an integral part of life. The sooner we understand this, the better. It's a truth that can set us free to live well, to love well, and in the end, to die well. He concludes the essay this way: I can't think of a sadder way to die than with the knowledge that I never showed up in this world as who I really am. I can't think of a more graced way to die than with the knowledge that, as best I knew how, I showed up here as my true self, able to engage the world in freedom and with love, because I had become fierce with reality. Living whole. I recently heard a colleague approaching retirement reflect on their life and career. He reflected on it in a way that caught me up, that led me to reflect on how we usually engage in life assessment. Rather than looking at his life as fragmented segments, family here, vocation there, and interests, hobbies, fun pursuits over there, he tried to see it whole. Using some of the work of poet and philosopher David White, he took as a starting point what White calls the three marriages of our lives. White suggests that we look at our lives as the confluence of three marriages: the marriage to self, the marriage to spouse or significant other, and the marriage to vocation. Now, you might rename or reallocate the marriages. You might say to self, to others, perhaps starting with those closest to you, and perhaps then moving out a bit. And perhaps you would rename that last one to purpose. But however you imagine the focal relationships of your life, there is profound richness that can be unearthed in looking at them closely. Most commonly these days, I hear when people talk about life assessment, about looking at their lives, I hear people speaking about work-life balance. Even you retired folks who aren't formally working anymore, it seems to me you're busier than most of the full-time working people I know. So you too have to think of those things that are like work for you and those things that are not, and how you keep that in balance. And yet, this whole notion of work-life balance has always felt to me too reductive and too simplistic. Isn't my work and my vocation one facet of my life? Don't I attempt to do more than simply teeter on the edge of a balance, like a gymnast on a balance beam, between the two, like my work is on one side and my life is on the other? What if, rather than balance, we thought, as White seems to suggest in his notion of marriages, what if we thought about allegiances? To what and to whom have I committed my life? How do I embody and express those commitments? Would people who don't know me, or at least don't really know me, be able to tell what matters most to me by looking at a routine day in my life? Think about that for a moment. If someone watched you on a typical day, what would they think were your life commitments? What would they think would be the things that mattered to you most based on where your time and your energy and your heart seemed to be placed on that given day that they watched you? Let's take each marriage in turn and return to Parker Palmer's notion of fierce reality as we examine our relationship with ourselves this morning. I find Palmer's vision compelling because I think he is right that if our relationship with ourself is not functional, not based on what is real and true, not based and rooted in what we have been and done, as he said, then it is nearly impossible to imagine any other marriage going very well. Are you with me? If you are not right with you, you are not going to be doing much good in the world. Am I right? If you wake up in the morning and you look in the mirror and you don't like what you see, how's that day going to go? If you don't know who you are, where you are broken, and what makes you come alive, then how can you love another person? How can you know what stands to take in the world for love and justice if you don't know what matters to you? Friends, our lives are our primary text. We look at each chapter and each verse of what we have been through, and we extrapolate from there, and we think about what we have been and what we have done and what we have known and who we have loved. And we try to make sense of it all. And when we really know who we are, not just on the surface and not just in the ways that are easy, oh, mistake here, good job there, we find that we live each and every moment with more depth. We live each and every moment with more of a sense of urgency, with more of a sense of presence, because we know who we are in the doing, in the being. Because we have come to see and love and care and hope as we do because of the lives we have lived. We can and do, and of course we grow and we change as we go, but our formative experiences and fundamental approaches to life are rooted in the life that we have led up until now and how we have interpreted those experiences. As Palmer suggests, we are not always fierce in our honesty with ourselves. We soft-pedal our shortcomings, or conversely, we're much too hard on ourselves. And seeing ourselves clearly, we find, is no easy task. It's a lifelong project to continue to look at who am I really? Who have I been? Where have I fallen short? And what do I still long to do with this precious life I have? Marriage to self. Then there's the marriage to spouse or others, which is the next realm. The quality of our connections to those closest to us says a great deal about us. How much time do we actually give to those we love? When we can't give them our time, have we nonetheless conveyed some way and somehow that they are of central importance to us? if you were to die tomorrow, or you did, would you feel at peace with the terms you are on right now with those who are closest to you? How much are you honest and open and self-disclosing in the most intimate relationships in your life? And I don't just mean your marriages, I mean in your deepest, closest friendships. How self-disclosing, how open are you with your friends about where you have fallen short, about your strengths, about where you're proud of things you have accomplished? When you expand outward from those primary connections, if you hold human connection and community as high values, how does that come through in every interaction in your life, no matter how small? Would everyone be able to tell in their interactions with you that connecting truly and deeply with other human beings is something that really matters to you? Or would they think, wow, that person didn't even acknowledge I was here. That person looked right past me. They didn't give me the time of day. What would the last person that you interacted with think about your place in this world? I got my hair cut this week. And speaking of, yeah, it's a good cut, right? And speaking of conversations, no matter how small, I find that I often gauge how well I'm doing at relating to others by how well I'm doing at relating to Jay, my hair cutter. If I sit there for the hour while he's cutting my hair and I hardly talk to him, then I feel a little bad. Like I've made him feel a little bit like I don't care about what's going on in his life. Like I'd rather he just be quiet and not share anything with me. But this time, when Jay and I were interacting, we had an interesting chat after we finished talking about his tattoos and their meaning. After we finished talking about summer vacations and the weather, he remembered that I was a minister, and so he started talking to me about a recent conversation he had had about beliefs. And in the end, he said to me, you know, what it comes down to, Shauna, what I've decided is I don't really care what someone's belief system is. It doesn't matter to me if they're Jewish or Buddhist or Muslim or what their faith tradition is. What really matters to me is how that person is in the world. And we had a little back and forth, and I said, Jay, you know, that lines right up with something that I had read recently of a rabbi saying that what matters is not exactly what kind of God you believe in. What matters most is who that God makes you, or what your belief in that God has done to how you live your life. This is a different level and layer of conversation from the conversation that Jay and I usually have. But it made me realize that we were really connecting, because we were connecting about what matters and things that we'd been thinking about in our lives. So what kind of person do your beliefs make you? Whether you're an atheist or an agnostic or a humanist or a theist, whether you're a Buddhist or a Jew, whether you're someone who grew up Christian and still carries some of Jesus's life stories around in your being, what kind of person does that make you in the world? How do those beliefs shape you? Do you lean on them? Because if you don't, then what good are they doing you? Or maybe that simply means it's time to get a little more fierce with reality again. The final realm of White's marriages model is the marriage to work, or perhaps even more accurately, the marriage to vocation. How well are you living out your sense of calling in other words. This is more than just a marriage to what you do or what you do to earn a livelihood. It's a question about how well you are doing in your marriage that has to do with your living out your sense of who you were meant to be in the world. This is that sense of true self of which Palmer speaks, which Reverend Melora and I have sometimes referred to as best self. Whether you refer to it as true self or best self or deep self, it's about living in a way that you feel is the way that you were meant to. Living in a life in a way that feels in alignment with what you feel you were meant to fulfill in this life. Living as only you can, without pretension or grandiosity, but humbly and fully filling your part in the family of all being. Now, I could do a whole sermon on just that point, because that's a hugely central part of my own personal theology, that I think each of us has a role to fill in this larger family of being, of life with a capital L, and that if any of us is not filling that part, then we are all the lesser for it. But you don't have another 15 minutes, so let me wrap up. When we feel we are living up to and out of the commitments that are most primary and most fundamental to who we are at peace in a way that no one can take from us, in a way that no experience can take from us. So even if in a particular given week, you weren't as nice as you would have liked to have been with your kids or your friends or your family, even if you snapped at the customer service person on the phone, even if you didn't speak up for the values that you believed in when somebody at the dinner party said something that you felt was horribly wrong, those deep commitments endure. The commitments that are primary and fundamental to who we are, when we live those commitments, we are at peace. We fall short at any given moment for sure, but on the grand scale, or at least on the only scale that we can weigh our lives, if our marriages feel healthy, then we feel at home in our living. Balance is a false goal. We are, have you noticed, never balanced. We have never been able to and never will perfectly divide our time between all aspects of our lives. It's just not going to happen. A reasonable, realistic, and even essential life goal is ensuring that we are putting time and energy and whole and true self into the commitments that matter most in our lives. That we are putting time and energy and whole self into those things that make us who we are. So go forth into the rest of this summer seeking not balance, but wholeness. Living your commitments as fully and as deeply as you are capable. May it be so, and may you be fierce with reality.